Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome to Books Boys, live from the Grand Library, the Dean and PJ.
Este es PJ, yo soy Dean, y nosotros somos los chicos de los libros.
¡Sí! ¿Qué tal todos? ¿Cómo están? ¡La música venezolana! ¡Bailando con Bumba the Boys! ¡Bailando con Bumba the Boys! Me gusta estar bailando con Bumba the Boys. Me gusta estar bailando con Book Boys. Book Boys, Bumba the Boys. Tan confuso.
Yeah, the Merry Alfred dancing there.
A belated Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Sponsored by Bookish Man with very low voice, sounding like they should work for television.com.
And that was improvised. And este es el programa de los chicos de los libros. Cógelo, cómpralo, libros.
Sí, comprar.
Okay, I thought I should do the intro in Spanish since I keep reading so many damn Spanish books. But Merry Christmas, everyone. Happy New Year and so forth. Feliz Reyes.
Merry Christmas.
Everything.
Merry Christmas. So I hope you all had a Merry Christmas and a jolly read during the jolly time. It's the end of the year. It's been a year, Dean. It's been a year.
It has. And if you go on our social media channels, I put up a little 2.5 minute video where I listed my top 3 books that I'd read this year. So you can go check those out. And I may be wearing sexy antlers. So just a little hint.
Well, if you want to see that, check out Patreon. So, well, actually, really, but...
So over on our OnlyFans, no. Did you know that if you go to booksboys.com, not only is there a link to our latest songs, the 2022 tips, but if you scroll right down to the bottom, we got some merchandise. You can get your Books Boys t-shirts just in time for, well, we missed Christmas, but it was out in time for Christmas. We just forgot to mention it last month because the show was that long.
And if you're feeling Espanol, you can also get something for, Reyes Magos, the 6th of January. That's where they celebrate Christmas in Spain.
Mm-hmm. And this usually I would be in Spain for that, but this year I'm not, sadly.
But instead you're reading a lot of Spanish books.
Well, that's it. But go get our t-shirts, get your Anna Karenina method and your Is This a Holiday?
Is This a Holiday?
And all the usual Keep Calm and Read Your Dickens and all the good things. Yeah. So, books, what's it all about? I was waiting for you to do the, libros. De qué se trata todo eso?
Libros.
But no.
No entiendo libros. ¿Qué son? ¿Qué son los libros?
They're paper subjects.
It's a thing that, guys, if anyone knows any updates on what books are, or libros, or knigi, or hon, I don't know, I've got so many different words, different languages. I believe it might be a compilation of leaves by now, Dean, that there's some hidden mystical method and message in them.
Deciduous leaves and sew them together. And it's books. Yeah. That's literally all you need to do.
Guys, I mean, that's all. Yeah.
PJ mentioned our Patreon. And if you go to patreon.com/booksboys, you can not only get this show a little bit early, you can get a free t-shirt on there as well. You can get some other bits and pieces. I think we put up some poems and you can recommend books for us. But you also get all of our extra shows. In December alone, we got Books Boys 3 days early. Then you got Playboys, episode 15. Alex and I did Much Ado About Nothing. another Shakespeare.
Why should he?
Then I put up two episodes of Music Man, where I just looked at some of my old songs.
Hot, hot, hot.
Dark Place Robert and I did the final two episodes of The Sandman on Dark Place Dreamers and a Caper Captains with Alex. We did the Agatha Christie Evil Under the Sun. So there's so many shows up there.
Nice.
Go get them.
Go get them. And it's only there for as
like
much as
$3 or £2.50. Exactly, yeah. It's less than coffee, I mean, now. You know, if you got a coffee for £2.50, you'd owe them money.
Exactly, yeah. And remember, guys, you know, instead of buying that, instead of buying that toilet roll and trying to find Shakespeare within, trying to find King Lear within the toilet roll, just, you know, you can check us out. And we've covered a lot of Shakespeare. We've shaken up his plays. And there's a lot of extra content coming next year as well, so.
Yeah, we can just announce it. Like, next year, we're going to do a lot of Greek plays, so. Guys, we got our Greek plays. Let's talk about what we read this month. I did read some Spanish stuff, but that's coming later. The first thing I read, I don't know if you heard of this guy, Victor Hugo. It's a little book, with a big book, called The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Don't know if you ever heard of this this thing.
I have indeed, and it is known for being a very big novel, I believe. Is that correct?
It's about 500 pages, so it's not huge.
Only 500 pages.
Yeah.
It's nothing for you.
We said, Victor Hugo, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, 1833 is when it was published in English. I think a year or two before in French, 1831, something like that. We're talking Victor Hugo. You know it, right? You've seen the Disney movie. Everyone listening has heard of The Hunchback, so I don't need to like go super in-depth. I'm going to say there's not very much of Quasimodo in this book.
What do you mean? So it's not like in a Disney movie then?
No, we're 160 pages in before we even get like the little baby Quasimodo appears. He appears very briefly once before that, but it's really not focusing on him that much. But also, it's a bit of the... bit of the Anna Karenina method in use here, because there's a lot of filler, you know, a good 100 pages of filler throughout this book. It'll sort of say, Quasimodo resided in the Notre Dame of Paris. Do you know about this church? I'm going to describe every feature of the building over the next 60 pages. And then
it's the manual for architecture. A manual for architecture instead of manual for agriculture, isn't it?
Yes. And then it'll sort of say, and now we're in the Latin Quarter of Paris. Here is a 40-page, prissy describing the Latin Quarter of Paris. It's a lot of wasted material. It really is.
Oh, Lord, okay. Well, look, it's a classic Anna Karenina. You got to do it, you know what I mean? You got to practice it. It's very amusing. It's very in, isn't it, at that like the 1830s towards the 18, even to the 1880s, you know.
Yeah.
It's a very big thing. Like, for a good 50 years, everyone's big into writing big novels. Like, yeah.
They are. It's interesting.
But there's very little story content, to be honest. It's just about description, isn't it? Realism, I suppose, yeah.
So,
fair enough, yeah.
Early on, they do briefly mention, we do briefly see adult Quasimodo before we kind of get to his birth later on and then his adulthood. He appears. So the book's a bit back and forward with the timeline, which I don't love anyway. But we immediately see that people are mean to Quasimodo. So they call him a devil of a man. Look, he shows himself. He's a hunchback. He walks, but he's bow-legged. He looks at you, but he only has one eye. You speak to him, but he's deaf. You know, and they just kind of make fun of him. And we don't like him. And we find out later that even when he's walking in the street, people will like stick pins in his hump to hurt him. And I don't know why. This book, the people are all horrible, and I don't know why.
It's reminding me a lot of The Perfume by Patrick Süskind. Did you see any parallels between the kind of being depicted as a monster and in Paris? Funny enough.
Yeah, I suppose I can see that, yeah. Now, for anyone that doesn't know, what Quasimodo does is he's the bell ringer, okay? So he rings the bells, and that's why he went deaf. He wasn't born deaf, but he did have the other deformities.
Okay.
But he can speak, you know, he's not mute or anything like that. What's interesting is he lives with this priest. So he was found, we find out a little bit later in the novel, he was found as a baby, and, you know, he's all kind of, I say mutilated, but he's not in a good state with all his various medical conditions and things. So the Parisians say, well, what do we do with this one, this little monster? Do we throw him in the river or the fire? And that's the discussion until the priest says, well, I'm actually going to just keep him and like let him be alive. So I thought I liked the priest, but that will change later. He's a kind of a monster himself. Maybe he's the real monster, actually.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. No, he's good to, well, he's not nice to Quasimodo. He's kind of a cold, serious man, but he takes Quasimodo in, gives him, you know, work and shelter and food, and he's never mean to him. You know, he's the kind of person who is a bit short with people or whatever, but they have a bond, and Quasimodo's very fond of him, but he's a bit of a villain to other people. Okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I get it. Yeah. So is he also kind of portrayed like a monster? He might not look like a monster, but like people think he's character wise.
Okay. I think that he's. He is actually the real monster. Okay.
Right. Okay.
So it's just interesting the level of disgust they have for like the vulnerable people in this novel. And not just Quasimodo, we see it other times as well. Like, oh, here's a poor gypsy girl. Let's just humiliate her and degrade her. Or like a poor person comes up and they say, what kind of clothes are these to be wearing? You've got to get your better petticoats than that. And it's like, well, I have no money for food and I'm dying of starvation, you know? And they're just like, well, where's your fancy clothes? Like, they're just horrible people. Yeah.
Right. You know, what I find interesting about it is it's, you said it written in the 1830s, and that's really the height of realism with Balzac, you know, parallel writing at that point, and Charles Dickens writing a bit later. But I mean, 39, in the late 30s. But I'm saying it sounds very much like naturalism more than realism, whereas, you know, like realism is all about more like the high class, not necessarily Balzac doesn't talk about the high class, but they talk about society, they tend to talk about more the realistic depiction of society, but they don't go so gritty into the really low class like naturalism. It sounds like it's going really kind of dark and, you know, Zola, Benito Pérez Galdós kind of esque.
Yeah, this, I would agree with that. Yeah, it gives me some, I see the Balzac parallels, to be honest.
Is there some humor? Because I find the one good distinction is realism is usually more humor than naturalism.
There's a little bit of humor once or twice, not a lot. Only a very small amount. Like, really, there's one scene in particular that stands out, which I'll get to in a minute or two. Rest of it, not really. And it's kind of sad. So Quasimodo, there's a girl called La Esmeralda, and she's the this gypsy girl. And she lives with this like, kind of a clan, almost like an underground kind of, you know, village of gypsies. And they call themselves, like, the Prince of Egypt and the King of Judea and all these different kind of things. And she's there, and they've captured a guy, and they're gonna kill him, and so she rescues this guy. So she's very respected among the gypsies because she's beautiful. Essentially, is the reason. So they're getting the guy to do ridiculous things, like we'll let you go if you can pickpocket this mannequin whilst wearing like all these bells and standing on a stool on one leg and, you know, twisting your body around. And he's like, well, then I'm gonna ring the bells, and then you're gonna kill me, and they're gonna hang him. And at the very end of it, they say, well, you can join us and become a rogue instead. You'll still get hanged, but not by us, by the authorities. And they say, well, oh, hold on. We have a tradition. You can escape with your life if any woman will marry you. And all the women say, no. We want to see him get hanged. We want to see him get hanged. And in comes La Esmeralda. And she goes up and she rescues him and she marries him. And she saves him. And they all respect her.
No spoilers, Dean.
Well, we're still quite early in the book here.
You're a shocking man for the spoilers. You know, desperate.
They don't have any real kind of relationship. She just saves his life. She's not interested in him. Okay, so this is important. He's quite devoted to her, and in particular to her pet goat. But that is basically it. And he loves the goat, I think, more than her in the end. He never touches her. She won't, you know, sleep with him. He doesn't try to force it. He's just kind of happy that she saved his life, really. You know, it's a sham marriage. Quasimodo sees her, and he also loves her. And he gets involved with someone who's trying to carry her off. And he gets in trouble for it. So they want to also hang Quasimodo, essentially. And there's, at one point, she gets captured as well, and there's torture. It's a very, very rough book at times. But she never respects Quasimodo, even though he rescues her and he gives her sanctuary in the cathedral at the end. And she never respects him. And he keeps saying, you know, you respect this captain. She fancies this, you know, kind of captain who's a bit of an ass to everyone. But... yeah. He just likes the outer beauty. And Quasimodo has this moment where he realizes, oh, no, it doesn't really matter what I do for her. I saved her life. I bring her food and whatever. She's just going to like the pretty boy. And that's it. And there's touching, this isn't really a spoiler, but it's a touching moment where she says to Quasimodo, go out and find the guy I like. And he goes out and he waits outside the house all day and all night into the dark. And eventually the guy comes out with another woman. And he tries and he pulls the guy's horse and he says, come, come, like a girl wants you. And the guy says, you think I have to go to every girl who wants me? You're pulling on my horse's strap as though you think it's the gallows, which is all you should be pulling on. And Quasimodo doesn't want to tell this woman that the man has betrayed her. So he goes back and just says, I couldn't find him. And then she berates him. Well, next time you stay out there all night in the cold and the dark until you find him. And he doesn't want to disappoint. So it's very cruel. This is the Balzacian kind of bits, you know?
Okay.
And I feel bad for him, you know? And this the reason that the priest is bad, okay, is because he also loves Esmeralda. He kills someone else, or he tries to kill the captain.
Oh, hold on, not too many spoilers, dude. It sounds like a lot of spoilers now.
We're really only touching the halfway point. I mean, I'm not going to go any further. But the priest tries to kill the captain.
That's not a very nice thing to do, no?
No, it's not ideal, actually. It's not ideal. Esmeralda gets in trouble for it. She gets arrested. The priest denounces her for the murder that he thinks he committed to get her killed because he feels religious guilt for his, like, sexual frustrations. So he would rather kill the object of it.
Right, okay.
It's, you know, he tries to get her killed, essentially, and Quasimodo saves her, and then it's a whole big thing. But I'm not going to...
But again, this doesn't sound like a book that I would necessarily read. It just sounds a bit, you know, depressing.
Are depressing, but, you know, there's gypsy uprising and everything like this. But what the funny bit is when Quasimodo is on trial and he's deaf and the person doing the trial is also deaf. So the guy's answering questions and Quasimodo doesn't understand them. So he answers what he thinks he's being asked, his name, his age, his occupation. And the guy's asking totally different questions, but they don't know. So then the crowd are laughing. So the magistrate increases the punishment because he says, well, whatever you're doing, you're making the crowd laugh. And he doesn't know that the guy's deaf. So that's
that's the funny part because it's so dark, yeah.
But that's the only real bit of... But I have a philosophical question for you. It's based on social contract theory, right? So you can read Hobbes and things like that, The Life of Man, Solitary, Nasty, British, and Short. Quasimodo is totally rejected by society, totally shunned. They offer him nothing, no protections. They want to kill him from birth. They shun him when he goes out in the street. They laugh at him. They attack him. Is someone who is so shunned by society subject to social contract theory? What's to stop him saying, I'm not a part of the society, I'll just go ahead and massacre everyone? You know, he's been utterly rejected.
That's a good one. A cool question, actually. Yeah, I mean, because they're not respecting the rules either, right? That's the thing. They don't respect the rules either.
Made him an other. Like, he's not part of the system, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not going to spoil anything else. The only thing I haven't mentioned at all is there's a small side story about this old gypsy lady who lost her daughter. And it's just funny because she's like in this house and she won't have the warmth. She won't eat. She doesn't want the fire. For years and years, she's like, no, I deserve nothing. I'm going to be here. I'm going to be cold. I'm going to be hungry. They bring her a cake and she's like, no, just bring me some moldy bread. God. Turn the heating down. Like, you know, she's like, the gypsies took my daughter away. And of course, her daughter disappeared like the same day that like Esmeralda appeared or something like this. And she never puts like two and two together like the whole time, you know, throughout most of the book. And it's like the reader picks up on it like instantly. Like, this is probably your daughter. But she hates Esmeralda. Just, my daughter was taken away and this gypsy girl replaced her by some kind of magic. So she hates her. And it's like very clear that it's her daughter.
Is the Disney film any kind of realistic for, you know, adaptation or not?
I haven't seen it in 20 years. I don't remember.
I haven't seen it, I can't remember. I'm just wondering. But it usually is a very liberal.
Adaptation. I think they make them a little bit nicer, I suppose. But look, quick final thoughts. There's boring bits, there's sad bits, and there's a couple of funny bits. But overall, I think it's a good book. I would recommend it. If you've ever been curious to read it, there's a few tedious bits to get through, but overall, I think it's a fun book. It did take me 2 weeks to read, actually, because it's kind of slow at times. It's not always the most riveting. It's not a page turner. You know, you're not like, okay, I need to read another chapter. You're kind of like, yeah, I'll put that off till tomorrow or the next day.
Okay.
But you know, overall, it's not too bad.
Hmm.
So what I'm just going to do real quick before we hear some books of PJs is a quick little ad for our shows.
The facts that will be presented are true.
Yes, PJ.
Hello there.
Now, PJ, what have we learned about Shakespeare?
This is a hard attack!
Hello.
Dark Place Robert and Playboy Alex.
Doing all right. Glad to be here again.
So I'm giving you those nicknames. I'm not a fan of that one. Well, that's where people will know you from.
Nobody's
that's why.
Gonna know me from that one. But let's carry on.
Hello there. Can you hear me?
Join us for Shakespeare written, Spanish plays and poetry, rock star interviews, film reviews, Dark Place Dreamers, and more. Patreon.com/booksboys.
Is this a holiday? That's the salient point. We'll also give
that's very important. Is this a holiday, guys? And I'm still asking myself. Oh, look who just came in. Hello there. Uncle Joe, how are you? Sure, not too bad. How are you, Sam? Look, I just came in to sing a song there. Hold on. Once I was a young boy, I read a lot of books. I read a lot of books as a young man in County Cork. And the girls did love me, for I was a very bookish fellow. And when you read a lot, you will be a lovely man. They told me, my mama told me I was a lovely boy because I read books. Down the river, down to County Cork, all day long. And when I discovered Patreon, I immediately booked for Books Boys Patreon, only for $2.50 or €2.50. I'm not quite sure the price. I was confused. Did I get it wrong?
Three, something.
Something like that. Anyway, that's another song there for you. All right, thanks, Uncle John. I'm doing the show. Do you mind? Just sure, if you want any time in another song there, just say so, you know. Thanks, Uncle Joe. Fine, sorry. Okay, sorry about that, lads. Just, you know, sometimes you can't laugh at
John with his quadruple back and tando. So,
Uncle Joe, yeah. Anyway, sorry about that, Churchill, lads. Yeah.
Or should I say Amelie? I'm not sure. what have you read?
So the books I've read, I've been getting into, as I mentioned, I was reading a lot, Jerry and Esther Hicks, and I was reading deep into that just a few days ago, finished it. So I've been reading that for the last 2 months. Highly recommend that. If you want to find out more, check out Asking Is Given, the first book I've reviewed in last episode. Highly recommend it. And I also read 3 children's books. So that's it. Keeping very minimal this month. And the first one I read is The Dog That Nino Didn't Have. It's a Dutch book. Just came out a few years ago, I think 2015. And yeah, what did I think of this? It's basically a book about a boy who wishes to have a dog. So he imagines a dog. And it's basically always about, he's always playing with the imaginary dog. It's a big, big picture book. And he's always going around with a dog until one day he gets a dog from his parents. And yeah, they seem like, oh, it's the end of the story, but it's all good, right? But the boy actually becomes sad because all of a sudden the dog he imagined, the dog that Nino didn't have, is gone. And really this imaginary dog was his best friend. And this other dog is a normal dog, but it's not doing all the things that he really imagined he was doing with the dog he didn't have.
Right.
So it's kind of a poignant kind of story about, yeah, imagination. You know, sometimes you kind of, you get like the toy. You get a toy and then all of a sudden it's not as good as what I imagined it to be. Mm-hmm. Well, not good in my imagination, all the games I had. But it's got a nice ending. I'll tell the endings from the children's book because, you know, I think...
Not PJ, the spoilers for the niños.
my niños... Parents, please cover the ears of the niños. And I'll tell it to the parents. It's got a nice ending, which is basically he starts, all of a sudden, other animals appear. And they're black and white, the animals, imagine. They're kind of fady, you know, they're kind of ghost-like. And all of a sudden, he has a kind of a giraffe and an elephant. And his dog is back, the dog that he didn't have. But he still has the dog that he that he actually has in his real life, in his non-imaginative life. And all of a sudden he realizes, well, the whole house can be filled up with all the animals I wanted to, and I could still keep, and I can still be friends with the dog that I have. And that's kind of the end of the book. It's just, you can kind of combine imagination with your
books,
real life.
Note the hypocrisy in the spoiler policy. Just note.
Well, look, I told the kids to cover up their ears, right? So I think
I'm going to need to get this fun spoiler policy in writing, laminated, because
I'm always going on about it. Anyway, beautifully illustrated, and it's written by Edward van de Vendel. I hope I gained the Dutch accent right. It's not my strong language. And it's called, as I said, The Dog That Nino Didn't Have, or Nederlands, het hondje dat Nino niet had. I think that was a very bad pronunciation, so please forgive me. And auf Deutsch, der Hund, den Nino nicht hatte. Anyway, that's my first book, recommended, won some prizes as well. So it's a nice little back to the Dutch literature. We didn't talk about that for a while. And talking about Dutch literature, let's move on to the other two kids' books written by another Dutch man, Hans de Bear. Now, Hans de Bear is an interesting chap, young Dean. I'm telling you why. He's a Nederlander, so he's a Dutch lad. He illustrates both and writes his children's books, but he writes in German. So he used to live in Switzerland, and he started a series of German language books called Kleiner Eisbär, the little polar bear. Okay. And I think these books in particular you would enjoy. They're a series of books. Basically, it's kind of like, it's kind of the same series of stories. It's kind of the polar bear for some reason kind of loses its way and is not in the North Pole anymore. Be somewhere completely different. But he makes his way back with the help of other animals and other friends he makes. So it's that kind of series of books. Very simple. I have to say, though, even though the stories are really simplistic, I don't mean it in a bad way, it sounds negative, but I mean it very simple, I meant to say.
That's really, not always really bad. Yeah, that's fine.
I suppose so. They're really simplistic in a formula, though. But I think the high point here is his work as an illustrator. I think that's really strong because they're huge picture books, really beautifully illustrated, minimal text as well. And it's always about, it always starts off kind of North Pole, but it's always showing you other places in the world. And I really like the first one because Hans de Bear, he moved eventually to the Canary Islands. I'll get back to that in a second. And really the first book, Kleine Eisbär, wohin fährst du? Or in English, just where are you going to, Lars? So little polar bear, where are you going to, Lars? Is really, he ends up in the Canary Islands, is my theory. From the illustrations, there's an hippopotamus on the island. That doesn't exist in Canary Islands, but I recognize the mountain scenery. I think it's copied after Tenerife, the islands beside the one I grew up in. So I really recommend that, wohin fährst du, where are you going to? And then the next one is Little Polar Bear, Kleine Eisbär, Come Back Soon, Come Bald Wieder. And that one is same formula. So he kind of, in the first book, it's kind of a bit poignant. The part of the ice where he sleeps on, you know, melts away and he drifts off because of global warming, you know. And then he just drifts off and he ends up in a tropical island where an hippopotamus helps him find his way home. And the second book, he ends up being caught by a big net full of thousands of other fish. There's always an environmental theme to the books, which I like as well. Just not too heavy. Just for the kids, just like, you know.
It's a good theme, warning. Actually. It's good to get the kids interested.
Yeah, these books are written for, I think, maybe, any age up to 10 or so. So the first was global warming, but the second one is just overfishing and consumption, because it's quite disgusting because the whole page is a thousand fish and he's a very tiny polar bear, so it's very obvious. It's overfishing. And then he ends up in Hamburg. I think this is Hamburg. It's never clear where it is. Mm-hmm. In Germany. And a cat helps him, a few cats help him find his way back. But he's always, there's a third theme, which is just, so the first one's global warming, overfishing, but then when he's in the city, it's just dirty. So it's just like people not taking care of the cities, just pollution in general. He's trying to avoid his fur really dirty. It's always a very mild, subtle theme of some global issues. which I like, but it's really, really just very slow, very, very subtle, and it's mainly just story about him disappearing, meeting animals, and finding his way back. It was beautiful pictures, so I do recommend them, even though they might repeat.
Okay.
I'd love to read more, but those are the two I read. Highly recommend it. So get it. Hans the Bear, great name, by the way, for someone who writes about a bear. I think that is his real name, too. And highly recommend these Dutch authors. This has been a very Dutch month. So, Nederlands. So, Heel goed, I just want to say.
We should mention, you're actually back in Gran Canaria yourself now. I think that every month you've moved around. Every episode you're in a different place, but you're back in Gran Canaria. And I was also in Spain myself this month. I went with Dark Place Robert and Playboy Alex, and we traveled to sort of, I guess, southeast Spain. We visited Malaga, Marbella. We went to Gibraltar also, and even over to Morocco on the ferry. So I've been busy with my dancing in the early parts of the month, and I've been busy with my holidaying and in the later part of the month. But it's been a fun month.
I just moved back to Gran Canaria and moved to the north, to Las Palmas. So living in the south before was Ibiza. So I'm delighted to be here. I've done a lot of surfing, and I found a really beautiful home, really near the old town, Triana. And I've got a lot. I just got two nice books from a secondhand store. So I'm looking forward to some more interesting reading. Here they are, too.
Good.
So I can tell the listeners, I'm not sure if I read them straight away, but I did. They really call out to me. And Mikio End the book. Remember, Momo, really like that book.
Yeah.
And what I'm looking for particularly is some more Canarian literature. So that okay. there could be some of that coming up. Now, good. I always like reading regional literature where I am. So this is a play by a guy from La Palma. So I've never heard of it, but I'd love to nice. Check it out.
And the secondhand bookshop, is it an independent store, or is it part of the... Because I know in Spain there's a big chain called Reread that I really love. Is it a Reread?
Excuse me, sorry. Yeah, no, I don't know Rereads. No, oh, but wow. That's very surprising. That doesn't exist in Canarians. There are two really lovely bookshops. This one was actually found more in a utensil secondhand shop where okay. I also, funny enough, found this cuatro, which I've been playing all day to you guys. Mm-hmm. Venezuelan instrument. So I've been playing that to you kids. But no, but I'm just delighted. There's a lot of good. There are two really good bookstores. I'd like to show you one day. Plus, you got Benito Pérez Galdós Museum, his house where he grew up, the legendary Marianello author. And yes, there'll be more Canary literature coming up in the future.
Good. Awesome. Well, I'm going to move on to the next book that I read. You may remember last month we chatted to a lovely gentleman, J. Reader Archuleta, and he was very kind to send us two more books. And I did one of them this month. I actually just read it yesterday. So the last one that we read was short stories. And the next one we're going to do next time is a novel, as far as I can tell. This is something in between. So this is ostensibly short stories, but the stories are all different chapters in the life of the same person, Josh.
Right, yeah.
So it's essentially a novella in like different snippets, you know?
Yeah.
And I really like it. And it's only 100 pages. You know, I did read it in a day. But it's, you know, it's good. We start, and they're all set in Texas, right? And this guy, Josh, you know, you don't realize at the beginning that they're going to be connected. So this first story is about Josh and his, presumably his mom, Belle. And essentially they get in the car and she says, take your things and go. And I don't know if it's his dad or if it's her boyfriend or who it is, but they go away and never come back. And they ditch the man. And I thought, okay, that's a one and done story. But then I noticed the character in the next one is also called Josh. So I realized, okay, we're actually doing these different little scenes. The name of the book is The El Paso Red Flame Gas Station, by the way, for anyone that's interested.
Nice title.
It's a nice title, yeah. So that's the first story. I'm not going to go through like all the stories, but I'm just going to give a couple of highlights. They move to this town and he has... it is one of the stories where they get involved. It is a bar fight. So he's not always the main character in all the stories. You know, there's one where there's a bar fight and the guy goes home and kills his wife. And they don't even, Josh isn't really part of it. He just happens to kind of see it, some of the conversation in the bar.
He's a recurring character.
Some of them he's the main character, but not all. But they do, there's some interesting things where they talk about, well, of course, you know, his wife was sleeping with half of us. So, like, you know, he was going to kill her. And they talk about beauty, but they try to kind of philosophize it almost, like, well, it was her fault for the beauty and things like that. But you never get to see too much into it, because they're 15 pages, then you're on to like a year later or something, you know, so you don't always get a lot of backstory on some of the individual characters. But as we get towards the end, we do see more characters recurring, and there's some that I like. So there's a girl, Missy, that is, I guess, his kind of girlfriend, but she's not very supportive. But there's a nice little Mexican girl who's much, much more supportive. And he has a friend who says to him, you should stay with this girl. You know, she's in love with you. She's very good to you. And, you know, she goes to watch you. He does a football match and he breaks his nose, but he's the kind of hero of the game. American football, you know, not real football. And all this kind of stuff. But it's just, it's tough, because there's times where he's working in the gas station, in the title. Maybe he's sleeping on like a mattress in the back of someone's flat with no bedding and very little food, because these are stories of poverty, you know, and kind of struggling to get by. Yeah, maybe you've got a bad start in life. You're an honest, hardworking person, but all you can do is like pick up a laboring job here and there. Someone wants you to build a fence for a week, so you make a bit of money this week. You know, it's not, this is not Vanity Fair, okay? These are kind of people that are just trying to kind of get by in a bit more of a rural, but sort of this Texan lifestyle. And it's just the sad parts in it as well, you know?
Again, the heritage of naturalism, you know, instead of romanticism or even realism. Yeah, he mentioned that he really focused on the people that he knew. Guys, remember, if you want to check out the interview, it's just in last month's episode. And yeah, I thought it was interesting. Yeah, it's a good. There's a kind of I'm not an expert in American literature, but correct me if I'm wrong. But it seems to be a trend with, you know, the Steinbeck and the Tennessee Williams, and these authors appearing in like the 30s onwards. I feel Great Depression onwards, where they kind of the 29 monetary crisis and all that, kind of seems to be a trend. Americans to talk about that struggling American, not just the perfect American dream, but struggling American trying to achieve that.
I'm not usually a fan of the American literature that much, so I must say I don't know too much about the stereotypes and the trends in it, you know. But I really enjoyed this book, and that's the second of his books that I've really enjoyed. So, Mr. Archuleta is a very good author, and of course, to add one extra little thing. There's a detail that at one point the mother just disappears, and, you know, she says she's going out and never comes back and leaves him on his own. That's an extra little bit of sadness. Wow. But most of it, he's in high school. Okay. But it's a very, very good, very, very good book.
Yeah. That sounds, I would rather read that than Hunchback of Notre Dame, just from what you're telling me. Because Hunchback of Notre Dame just seemed unnecessary cruel, whereas I find this book sounds more like, okay, there's a real life happening and he's observing it, this Josh character. Yeah, I like the sound.
Yeah, I would say that's fair. Hunchback, there was unnecessary cruelty. I think that this was certainly better by a degree.
Yeah, just explaining it. Interesting.
So next I read a real Spanish classic. We're talking, I think, 1499, I believe it was released.
Is it, let me guess, Lope de Vega?
No, it is La Celestina by Fernando de Rojas.
All right, yeah, sorry, Lope de Vega, I think, is later, yes.
I actually never heard of the author. I didn't recognize the author's name, but of course I recognize the book title. Like, I've heard of La Celestina,
right, yeah. Well, it's famous. He's just famous for that, I think. Usually, I'm afraid to say, a really unpopular book for students who have to, they often have to read that book, and I haven't actually read it.
Right.
No, nothing about this time. So tell me what you think.
I'll give you my thoughts in 3 seconds. I didn't like it.
Yeah. Oh, well, there you go. A lot of students say that, but I mean, it's supposed to be a classic. So what's the reason why it's a classic?
It's again, I tried, maybe it was interrupting my holiday and I wasn't taken to it very well, trying to read it. And it's only 300 pages.
You're trying to read really old Spanish, just 1499.
I know. It is old Spanish, you know, and it's just, it's slow. There's bits where nothing seems to be happening for pages and pages at a time. The writing style, I didn't find particularly engaging. You know, I would read it and I'd be like, what am I even reading? I'm not paying attention. Like, I'm distracted. I'm not even focusing because it's boring, you know? And in the end, I really felt that I had done the book a disservice. And I went and I read some reviews that, of course, said it's the greatest piece of Spanish literature ever. And it opened the transition from medieval to Renaissance literature in Spain in 1500 and all this kind of stuff. It's the Spanish Romeo and Juliet. Cool. If you read like a one paragraph summary of the book, you're like, oh my God, all these things are happening. But yeah, that one paragraph happened over 300 pages with just like filler and nothing in between. And that's the problem.
Oh, so it's a prototype of the Anna Karenina method. Yeah. Maybe it's time for the La Sistina.
Essentially. And also, it's written as a play. So it's a 300, right. It's like a 300 page play. So it's quite tough to get through as well. It's pure dialogue with no narration. I always complain about narration in the Latin American novels, but right, this is a little bit the other side, you know?
Right, okay. You like a little bit of balance, don't you?
I like some kind of balance, yeah. I like just a normal novel, you know? But a couple of interesting things. There's a chap, Callisto, who's in love with Melibea. And there's a funny line where he says something about, like, well, that's very Christian. And someone says to him, Sempronio says, are you not Christian? He says, well, I'm Melibean because I love Melibea, and that's all my thoughts and dreams and everything is about Melibea. So he's declared her as his religion. Like, that's all he cares about, you know? And there's another funny moment. I like that, yeah. There's a chap called Centurio, right? And someone says to him, why are you Centurio? And he says, well, my dad was also Centurio. I'm named after him. And they say, well, was your dad a commander of 100 men? And he says, no, but he was the pimp of 100 prostitutes.
Right, so it does seem to be quite liberal, I suppose, from the content.
So look at the main characters here. Centurio is not a main character, but he is a kind of pimp, and there's multiple prostitutes in this novel. You know, Celestina is my version describes her as a bawd. Essentially, she's a brothel keeper.
Right. Well, that sounds good. That sounds like a good novel right there. It sounds like a good story.
I think the framework is good, and maybe I read it at the wrong time, or it was the old Spanish, or I was trying to enjoy my holiday. You know, I wasn't focusing on it. I was too busy probably talking to Alex about Shakespeare and Robert about Ferengi. I don't know. I didn't like it that much. But
well, it's nice that you. So a little side thing, but it's nice that you went on holiday with Alex and Robert. That's nice.
It was nice to do a trip. I travel a lot by myself, so it was actually very refreshing to travel with friends, you know.
Nice, yeah, cool. So, and not a book that you highly recommend then, okay.
I'm not going to highly recommend it. Really recommend. Okay. Yeah, pretty much. I'll give you the quick summary of what actually happens in it. So this guy Callisto is in love with Melibea, and he goes to Celestina, who's the kind of brothel keeper or whatever, and he asks her to help. And I think the idea is that she's going to get him some kind of like potion, or she's going to persuade Melibea, whatever it is. She's the seductress on his behalf kind of thing, and she's going to go and she's going to help him. But then the reason it becomes a bit of a Shakespearean tragedy is because it's just full of like these characters doing these grand monologues, and then they're all betraying each other, and like the two servants, Sempronio and I don't recall the name of the other one, Parmeno, I think it is. The two of them, you know, one of them gets on board with Celestina, then the other one's against her, then he gets on board, and they're going to betray Callisto. And then, again, no spoilers, okay? But it has the Romeo and Juliet tragedy, and it's just people dying left, right, and center by the end of the novel. I'm not going to say who or how or why, but it does get very, very tragic in an almost extreme. Like, you're starting to wonder, is anyone actually going to be alive, you know, at the end of this, just jumping off towers and falling in swords? But no, it's good in parts. But honestly, I just can't recommend it. The writing style is just not engaging. And I've read other old books. Like, I read Cervantes. It was tough to get through, but at least there was some engagement. La Regenta, not so much. This is more like that, you know?
Right, okay, yeah.
So I didn't love it, but if you're someone who's working your way through the Spanish classics, maybe it is just me doing that, then, you know, yeah, there's a couple of funny little bits in it. And, you know, I love the romance, right? I always love the extreme passion. That's my thing. So, sure. But maybe
I want to get through
modern translation or something.
Yeah, I want to get through some Canary literature. So we spent the of Hispanic literature talks going on. So it sounds like a very Año Español, you know, next year. So if you're into Spanish literature, that's probably, if you're into ancient Greek and Spanish, well, you'll be in for some delightful treats next year.
That's it.
Tune in. Tune in your radio or just your internet broadcast.
Turn your radio, yeah. Just, guys, turn your radio dial, turn it up to 10. Pull up the antenna, nice and tall, nice and wide, get the best signal, have all the family gathered around, switch from FM to AM frequency, and you'll be able to hear all the things that you want right there.
And snuggle up beside a fireplace or in front of a fireplace, make sure it's not in the fireplace. Crucial grammatical difference, according to Shakespeare.
That's
but
true.
Beside or in front, at, I suppose, will also be okay. Not in.
The next book that I read, PJ, is by a certain Elma Linz Canfield, and it's called, you might be interested in the title of this one and this lovely cover, Hamlet's Mirror.
I love the title and the cover.
This is an amazing lady who works in psychotherapy, and these kind of counseling sessions, and she's now chronicled some of this in her book, but very specifically, and the reason for the title, she only works with performers, dancers, actors, singers, and it's more about the specific challenges and problems facing those type of people, which are maybe different than the things that your average person is dealing with, right? And she worked for, you know, 3 to 4 decades in that field, and then kind of produced this book. And again, it's a short book. You can read it in a couple of days. I think it's 200 pages, something like that. But the idea, I suppose, you're not supposed to breeze through it. You're meant to kind of go through it more slowly. It has some little reflections that you can fill in to think about yourself, you know?
So it's Hamlet's Mirror is a guide for the struggling performer. For what exactly? That's what I'd like to know.
Is to reach your performance potential on stage and off. So it's about becoming, I suppose, you know, most self-help type books are all with the same goal of, you know, happiness and becoming the best version of yourself, right? And I suppose I would suggest that this is no different. It just has this unique slant of coming right at people of a particular kind from someone who has a lot of experience specifically with those kind of people, that being the performers, you know, so the expertise is there. But the book's full of little reflections. Here's an example. How preoccupied are you with your body image? How much does that impact on your performance potential on a scale of 1 to 8? And you go through these little ideas. And there's also various tableau where we look at some of her patients. Now, I don't know if she's got the permission or if she's used fake names, whatever it is, but there's examples given of, you know, cases that she's dealt with, and we get to see little snippets into the real lives of people and the struggles to get through. Because, you know, we get it. You're really getting depressed because you're not getting the role you want, or you get the role and you get into the role too much and you lose yourself in the role and it affects your interpersonal relationships in real life, or you're singing and you're too much strain on your voice and you start to doubt your abilities and all this kind of stuff, you know?
And you also mentioned she's a psychoanalyst. So is she delving into Freud and Jung, or
really that in the book, at least. It's more, I mean, it is specifically just designed to help these particular categories of people, you know.
Okay, but still with a psychoanalytical kind of upbringing, I suppose, right?
And background. I guess it's nice to see someone's expertise come in. Oh, hold on. PJ, we've got a phone call coming in here. Let's 2 seconds.
Okay. Is it going to be?
Hello, you're through the Books Boys. You've got Dean and PJ on the line. Who's calling?
Oh. Who's this?
Yes, I'm Elma Lynn Canefield, and I'm a psychotherapist and a life coach, and I work exclusively with performing artists. So if the secret caller is a performing artist, I'd love to speak with you. I just published a book called Hamlet's Mirror, Reaching Your Performance Potential, based on the belief that Hamlet mused, it is our artist, after all, who hold the mirror up to life, reflecting everybody.
Wow.
Okay. Wow. Well, interestingly, by great coincidence, we were just talking about the book, and I've got my lovely copy right here. So
the timing, crazy coincidence.
Perfect timing strikes again. Tell me more about the title then. So was Hamlet's Mirror always going to be the title, or was that like a last minute thing?
It was.
I love the title.
Thank you. It wasn't a last minute thing, but once upon a time, the title was The Diva Syndrome, which is in the book.
Yeah.
And the Diva Syndrome is what prevents artists or anybody from reaching our performance potential. But it was such a downer. I used to go on ships and lecture about the Diva Syndrome, and halfway through my lecture and what I said, I heard people were snoring. It was so depressing.
So
I reevaluated because I thought it was a great title. I reevaluated and put it in the book in its appropriate place.
Yeah, and it is still in the book. And I think it is interesting because it's an important thing to think about, right? The Diva Syndrome is something that will affect performers. And I suppose there's a reason why you wanted that as the title originally. Dealing exclusively with performers. Why is that, by the way? You know, so obviously you've got your training. You could deal with anyone, I suppose. What made you really want to focus on, you know, actors and vocal artists and musicians and things? What was the real inspiration to work with those types of people?
Me. I wanted to be a performer once upon a time.
Right.
And I had an experience where I was about to sing and everything seemed in its place and I was ready and I opened my mouth and nothing would come out. And I went to doctors and boards were fine and nobody could help me. Nobody really understood the psychology of the performing artist. And I left the profession, but I went back to school. And of course, there were no courses in that, but I studied and figured out. And in St. Louis, had a some of my population, treatment population, were artists. And I decided I'm going back to New York and open a practice exclusive to performers. I thought, you know, I'd have a lot of competition, but nobody, this was in the 80s, had this kind of practice. So I don't know if it was timing or what it was. And then I had the opportunity to start the counseling services at the Juilliard School. They had never had a counseling services, so very busy.
But you find something, you know, you find something that other people weren't doing, and you find people that needed help that weren't getting help. So that's great.
Yeah, it was. It's been just a really, really rewarding career.
Great.
Well, when we go through the book, we get to see a little bit about the unique struggles that performers face. You know, there's this I am what I do idea that actors have, that they almost get drawn too much into the roles. And we see that some examples given of that affecting their relationships in real life, you know. And then there's the dancers, you know, dance through the pain, push your body to the limits kind of thing. And yeah, I suppose that I never realized it before, but performers do actually have a unique set of problems. And so I suppose it's really good to have something that can help them. And we should say, you know, with this book, it is designed to help them. There's various reflections you can fill in as you go through it and examples that you can maybe relate to. And I suppose the idea is that by reading this, it will help you to reach your potential as well. Have you heard some, you know, have people told you that it's helped them?
They have.
Good.
I've gotten responses that have been very touching. One of the responses that really surprised me was I told them about me and what had happened to me and how I found, quote, my performance potential in my work. And yeah. I do that in various ways. And that seemed to allow readers to trust the information in the book as much as my clinical credentials. And that really surprised me.
Because they could relate to you as a person, as a co-performer, right? I think that gave it the, yes.
I guess so. But yeah. I was so young.
I think relatability really helps. You know, experience, expertise. You know, you've got your knowledge. That's one thing. But having that relatability is what the ordinary person is actually going to find more attractive, almost to open up. I think so. It's great that you have that as well. You know.
Yeah.
Okay. So. The little reflections, those are interesting. I like going through and thinking, you know, here's an example of one. How often do you betray yourself for adoration and promotion? Well, I can be a little bit vain, so I think that I'm maybe quite high on that one, you know. But it was interesting to go through them and, you know, I'm not much of a performer. I do a little bit of dancing and a little bit of art, but I don't really perform. I make music. I don't perform it live. But it's interesting to even see a few little things that were helping me as I read through the book. And I thought, you know, okay, yeah, I do this one, or, you know, I'm not comfortable expressing myself in this particular way, or whatever it is. And I, you know, even as I wouldn't consider myself a performer, but I still took a few things away from it, I think, which is good. So I do think that, you know, anyone could read it and still benefit from it, you know.
I hope so, because it really took me 30 years to write this book.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is research. And I just learned so much about myself.
Yeah.
And the reflections, hopefully, really illuminate the concepts and that are being talked about. I don't see it as a book that you can sit down and read right through because it's so introspective and subjective. But
yeah.
People have said, boy, I sat down and I read it right through.
I did. For the purposes of review, you know, I have to obviously read a lot of books per month. So I did read it right through. But I felt instinctively that wasn't the best way to do it.
Yes.
You know, and I felt you're better maybe taking a little bit at a time, a couple of the reflections and thinking about it and taking it away. And if you're someone that is a performer and that wants to get help from the book, I would recommend going through it a little bit more slowly and yeah, meditating on it more, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Tell us a little bit about the performer personality profiles. So you list four. There's this triangle, this kind of drama triangle of problems. And we've got the problem-ridden performer, the pugnacious performer, the promising performer. And those are three, you know, areas where you're getting somewhere, but you're having some problems. And then we have the potential realized performer. And I suppose that's the one that we want to be, right? That's where we've dealt with our issues and our potential is being realized and we're on the right track. Do you want to open up a little bit about those or how you kind of came up with this and put those together?
Well, those really became apparent over the 30 years. The first two, the problem ridden and the pugnacious, are founded on really bad energy. Performer, not performer. Have you ever been around anybody who you've just?
Of course, yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah, you backed up. Yeah.
Okay, that's those two categories, and the problem-ridden performer is just full of fear and will avoid and flee anything. The pugnacious performer, and this I found really interesting, will be very successful for a while.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Motivated, driving, because he or she will step on anybody.
Yes.
But eventually, same result.
It doesn't last, yeah.
Because the energy is so toxic.
Yeah, you can't fight all the time either. You can't be like stepping the whole time. Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
And the, I guess, predominant feelings of that person is anger.
Hmm.
Right. Interesting. Yeah.
And that's not the right feeling for long-term success, I suppose.
No.
Well, that's not what people want to see the whole time, right? They would flee as well when watching anger.
I mean, how many people do you know like that?
Well, I don't spend enough time with them. That's the thing, right?
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. We don't want to. Yeah.
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 Now, the promising performer shifts that energy. And I call it harmonic energy. And they're fairly successful people. I mean, you see them in orchestras, corps de ballets, reoccurring parts on television, in film.
Mm.
You can identify them pretty easily. The challenges for the promising performer is that they're too giving in two ways. They rationalize a whole lot and settle, tolerate. They don't really look after their own needs, fearing. I don't want to be selfish. I don't want people not to like me. And they're very altruistic, which sounds, oh, how lovely. You know, such a nice fellow, such a nice person. However, this altruism is often in the service of being needed and loved. And when the need stops, they get very, very hurt. Oh, you know, what did I do wrong?
Yeah.
And they forfeited their careers often, you know, oh, you take this spotlight or you, there's a balance. So when you do things really for yourself, and it looks like for other people, it'll really hold you back. The thing to do is be real. You know, live your life in the moment, almost as an ad lib, and be real.
There's value in authenticity, yeah.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, you all have to do it, or you wouldn't have such a successful podcast.
That's true, and we just come on and we just be ourselves, you know, and
yeah, exactly.
I think that that's the way to go.
And that's,
I think it's often, yeah. I'm just saying, I think it's often the embarrassment of some people that they don't want to, oh, I don't want to, I need to be perfect and I don't want to fail, and it's embarrassing about the way I am. So I'm in every podcast episode, I am ridiculous in some part, at least, maybe not the whole part. Yeah, I don't really care anymore. I used to care, though, when I was also 18, 19, and when I've dared to say that. Yeah. You just got to be yourself.
You just have to be yourself and stay in the moment. And when you think of, oh, I need this outcome, I need this result, you're so far ahead of yourself that you kind of lose yourself.
Mm.
And that's trouble.
Well, Emma, one last question. Is there going to be another book, or is this, you've put everything into this and this is all you wanted to write?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's how it started.
You see, it always starts like that, and then you get the bug and you want to write something else.
I have learned so much since the book's been published, which is... It's amazing. So my answer to your question is I don't know.
Okay.
Okay.
That's a good answer. And the last question we ask everyone, but before I ask it to you, I'm going to just ask you something else. Would you like to give us a plug, tell people where they can get the book, or how to find your website, or something like that?
Well, you can get the book on Amazon and... I'm such a new author. I'm really bad.
Everything's on Amazon anyway, so at least you can get it there.
And you can get it at my web. You can look it up on my website, which is Elma Linz, L-I-N-Z, Canefield, .com.
Cool. And we'll put a link to that anyway in the show notes. Elma, thank you so much for calling in. Have a great rest of your day. But the final question we ask every author, this gives me a little idea about what you like to read as well as write. If there's one existing book that you wish you had been the person to write, what would it be?
Right now, it's... oh, God, I just reread it. The story of the... Oh, what's it called? The story of the woman... It's a novel. The story of the woman who lives in the swamp. What book am I thinking of? I just read it.
Swamp.
And she,
intriguing plot.
She was accused of murder.
Ooh.
And readers, listeners, help me. And she had a boyfriend who was the only person who ever really, her parents left her, and she lived in this lone house.
I can't think of it off the top of my head, but if anyone knows, let us know. booksboys@hotmail.com or on Instagram.
Come on.
So for the first time, you've given the show a riddle to solve before the New Year. So if you solve before the New Year's, there'll be special treats, everyone. So what's this set in a swamp?
The name. It was made into a movie, which wasn't as good as the book. So I reread the book.
What's the
worry about it. It's a riddle.
You got a riddle.
It's really good.
Well, you've reread it.
Can anyone smoke it? No. It's set in a swamp.
That I'd love it to be made into an opera.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. That's interesting. Okay. You have that feeling.
If I could of the name of it.
Elma, Okay. Thank you so much for joining us. We loved the book.
Yeah.
And thanks for your time. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, well,
yeah, some interesting and very interesting theory as well. So I kind of feel it can also work, even though you wrote this for performers, for also non-performers, so a bit about them, because everyone performs, has to perform a bit, teachers, policemen, you know. So I feel you've done a good thing. Thanks so much for calling.
Well, thank you, and very happy new year.
Yeah, happy new year to you too. Yeah.
So lovely and unexpected, of course, to have Elma call in. And if you think the book's of any interest to you, if you think that you're a performer and you want to maximize your potential, go check it out.
That's very surprising. Again, these coincidental calls, I just don't know how that happens. Next, we have
on a roll
Shakespeare calling in from the world beyond.
We almost had Zafon's ghost. So
exactly, yes. I thought, yes, indeed.
I read one more book. This one is from the 60s.
I immediately see that's a Spanish book just by the back cover there. That's a very distinguishable white cover for Spanish.
Yeah, it is.
What is it?
From the 60s, but it's not a modern novel because it's Gonzalo Torrente Ballester, Don Juan.
Oh, nice. Don Juan. Okay, so it's a no. So hold on a second. I've heard of Ballester before, but you got to remind me. Don Juan is an old story.
Yes, so I didn't know the author, but he's modernized it. Don Juan. It's been covered by Molière. It's been covered in poems. Yes. I think Byron. I think it's an old. There's older books. This is a modern retelling.
It's been covered in Spanish literature, particularly a lot. Yeah. But do you want to tell the new kids who were just born, maybe, like what it's all about?
Well, this one, I don't think this particular book is actually in English. And that happens sometimes.
Well, yeah, it's happening a lot. It was the German books as well, isn't it?
But look, this one, I'm going to go again. I liked it, but I didn't love it. So I think I had this idea like Don Juan, and I think the Italian version is Don Giovanni, isn't it? It's this idea of the ultimate womanizer, right? And, you know, even Buddy Holly has a song called Modern Don Juan, right? It's in the
poem. Right, yeah.
And it's the ultimate womanizer. And unfortunately, this book, it messes me around with the timeline. So it's set in the 60s in Paris with a modern person called Don Juan, who isn't the original Don Juan, but then there's like flashback scenes where we see the story of the original Don Juan. It's more like Superman versus Spider-Man, the origin story or something. It's like, how do we get the origin? How do we get the name? And I'm never a big fan of that and jumping back and forward. So that's the bit I didn't like, the storytelling device, the structure.
But it sounds like Harpo Wonderland and the End of the World, Murakami, you know, like two stories. Is it like chapter one?
That was well done, though, actually. This one, I found it hard to kind of know which Don Juan we were talking about and what was going on.
Very surprising. Okay.
And we see the various girls that he's attached to, but it's interesting, right? Because this Don Juan is old and impotent.
Oh, okay.
So this Don Juan cannot make love to the ladies.
Okay, that's an interesting.
And we hear a lot about it through his servant or his assistant or whatever. He's talking to the narrator and talking to other people about his master Don Juan. Don Juan is not interested in sex. Don Juan is interested in the art of seduction and the conquest. It's about knowing that you've won the person's heart, even though you're not going to physically make love to them afterwards.
Right, okay. I feel a bit sorry for Mr. Don Juan there, but okay. So, and this guy, the fella.
It's interesting. It's an interesting take on things, you know, and it's an interesting way to do it, I suppose.
Well, I do like taking old themes and old, myths and stories and then modernizing it personally, but changing it. Not modernizing, just giving it your own twist.
And, you know, I think that's fine. And I did enjoy it. I just didn't, it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. I wanted to see
it was going to be amazing.
Don Juan, you know, and I didn't get that. But we do see some girls in love with him. And I think one girl shoots him in the end, you know. And we even have a bit where one girl gives her his blood for a transfusion because they just want to save him because they love him so much, you know. But there's a really interesting bit. One of the girls, they actually, she's so in love with him. And they said, but what if you never see him again? Because he's traveling around, he's talking to different girls. And she says, I don't need to see him again. I just need to be in love with him for me.
Right.
Okay. He so deeply affects them with his wooing that it is pure happiness for them just to love him, even if they never see him again.
All right, okay, yeah. It's so sounding very obviously, it's obviously written by a man.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Was he himself an elderly, well, a man of a few years? Was he, I mean, this sounds like this was a man who was maybe.
I believe he was younger than us when he wrote this book. I could be wrong on that.
Okay.
But what's interesting is, and this is, I mean, it's not a massive twist or anything, but it's not a massive spoiler. At one point, one of the girls does see him again and doesn't recognize him.
Oh, interesting.
But she still talks about, but when are you bringing me to Don Juan? This great love I have for Don Juan. And she doesn't recognize him.
Isn't it criticism for like over-romanticism? Isn't he taking, isn't he taking this theme of Don Juan, which is very popular romanticism? There's a famous Don Juan version in the Romantic era, a great play. Mm. But isn't this a criticism of romanticism? You know, that's what the women are doing. They just romanticize. This is the whole concept of just your...
Yeah.
This is so typical romantic, the romantic era. I mean, like, you're kind of... Just your vision will warm me up in the middle of the night when I feel cold. And when I was 60, I'll be thinking of your right eyeball and I'll be so happy ever after. And, you know, this nonsense, basically.
I like it and I love romance. But what I don't like is the sexism, right? I don't like the womanizing.
It sounds like it's a criticism of all that, to be fair.
It is a bit,
it is really criticizing that.
But what I don't like is there's certain sexist phrases, you know, there's no cold women, there's only men who don't know what they're doing, who can pick up a guitar and don't know how to play it. You know,
but
this
idea
that women are easily wooed, you know.
But again, is Ballester kind of criticizing that, or do you think he's kind of like representing that?
I think it's represented to a point, but then it is... Overall, it is trying to criticize it, I think, you know.
Okay, well, that's the main point. But I don't know much about this.
Bits where they talk about, like, oh, well, we all know what Latina women are like, you know. And it's like, I don't like these kind of stereotypes when it gets a bit sexist or, in that case, almost racist. But I don't really like this sort of the conquering aspect, even though I do love the romance, you know.
Hmm.
But look, I'm not going to give spoilers, but it gets a bit crazy near the end. At one point, there's a case similar to Doña Perfecta, where the girl is being really kept, this time by her father. She's not allowed out to see the man folk. And she sits near her window watching the man go by, and she's like getting all excited. And Doña Sol, her kind of woman that looks after her, is trying to persuade her, like, you shouldn't be doing this, you shouldn't be interested in these men. Meanwhile, she's being seduced by Don Juan, you know. But the father...
What a melodrama.
Yeah, well, what a Marianella drama. But we end up with the father's ghost, and then it really loses me here. I don't really like to go out of the realms of the possible. I don't want ghosts, really, you know. So that's where it really loses me near the end, when it kind of... We end up with ghosts and things. But look, it's okay for what it is. There is an admirable part where at one point Don Juan wants to marry a prostitute. And she keeps saying, but I'm only like a poor prostitute and I'm too humble and I can't be interested in this. And he says, well, you're beautiful and I love you and that's it. I don't think he really sticks with her. He still leaves and leaves her on her own and she pines after him forever. But he kind of was happy to, he says, my status in society is high enough that I can raise this prostitute up to my level. And he was never, he was a rich man. He didn't worry about social problems, you know. He didn't care if he was going to be an outcast because he just does his own thing, essentially.
Hmm. Well, look, but what's interesting, a bit of history for this novel here. This is early 60s, and this is Spain. He's a mainland Spain author. And this is Franco at its, not quite at its worst ever, but he's not a pleasant fellow to be around was in the 60s. Spain is not good for the artists back then. And, this is one of the novels that caused the most problems, obviously, because it does sound like a very sexual kind of, almost like going
towards... It was pretty controversial upon release. Yeah, yeah, it was.
And he did accept, but it also made him... it was one of the main reasons why he got accepted to teach in the State University of New York, Albany. And so he went to U.S. So it's kind of like a godsend as well. So it caused him a lot of problems, but also made it possible for him to teach in New York, which was pretty cool. So sometimes it's interesting that sometimes you can get good and bad things from...
It worked out well, but yeah, it was essentially the cause of him leaving and going to New York. But as you say, it worked out well, so it's fair enough. There's a nice line as well where they kind of ask, what's the most one of the girls is capable of? What is her passion? What can she do? And she says, you know, what I'm capable of is dying for you, you know? And I do love that. That gets me every time, that level of like ultra romance, you know? Those are all the books I've read. Before we wrap up, PJ, do you have a recommendation for us this month? I'm done with the recommendations.
So. I thought we're done with the recommendations.
Well,
like,
I suppose this... it wasn't clear if you were also.
No, I think it's better to. I think we've got enough books to cover, but I might as well, just for old time's sake, maybe from time to time we'll do one. And from really out of the top of my head, really did not expect it because I thought we gave them that. I am going to recommend, let's see, one book that really comes to mind that I really love. But I haven't mentioned, it's been so many episodes, but it does become hard after a while. Let me think. Brief seconds. I am going to recommend, and I might have recommended him before, but I'm going to recommend Kobo Abe. And I believe I recommended the Woman in the Dunes before. Kobo Abe is like a quintessential 60s author, as we're in the 60s now. Very psychedelic. Talking about a lot of different themes, very existentialist actually. It's kind of like the Albert Camus of Japan.
Okay.
But I'm not recommending that book because I do think I recommended that one. So in fear of that, I'm going to talk about Kani no Tao, The Face of Another, I think it's translated as. And I think was it written immediately afterwards, also made into a movie by Teshigahara. And it's about a man who loses his face. Essentially, and he really tries to recreate it. He just wants to bond again with his woman, lady friend, was his wife. woman. And basically, he starts to reconstruct a face for himself. And there are two things I find really interesting about this book. First of all, it actually dwells into the philosophy of the face, which is something I've never thought about, you know. And I found it a bit slightly annoying with, for example, The Reader, where he goes into philosophy of law in part two of the book. But in this case, I thought, wow, this is so strange and fascinating. I never thought about faces. He actually studies faces and about, it's really all about like that he's shunned from society. We're just talking about it with The Hunchback of Notre Dame. And is he allowed? Does he have to comply to the social contract if he doesn't have a face? Because he just... people ignore him. He's more like a ghost. He's not like a monster.
Similar themes. Yeah, good. We've come full circle. Expert, professional, presenter.
Exactly. We've come into a full circle. And the thing was very interesting. He does start to become an inhuman kind of person because he doesn't have a face. And he tries to reconquer his wife. But it's kind of really just depressing and sad. And she plays along. It's slightly spoiling. Last spoilers here.
Okay.
But she does kind of play along with him, but he actually believes that he's got the mask and that she thinks he's another man. He kind of wants her to cheat. That's a bit ridiculous part, I find. But they talk 60 Japan is sometimes it's too much with the macho. It's very kind of anti-feminist, I find sometimes, but sometimes they also have a deeper insight to the more twisted male soul. So it's a bit of a dark novel, but The Face of Another by Kobo Abe.
Well, that's the last recommendation. We're done with them. But I will say quickly, if you haven't, go read or watch or experience in some way A Christmas Carol, because we've just done our Christmas time. By the way, I've got some research, PJ, telepathically. Oh. The book that our friend Elma was trying to recommend to us is Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens. 2018.
Oh, nice.
And it's a movie.
Nice. So
there you go. Cool. The telepathy wins again. Also,
have I seen this?
So, nice. I was going to play one of my songs to finish, but you've got a quattro there. Do you want to play something for us instead?
Can indeed. Let me just get it out here. And what's a song you'd like to sing, Dean, actually? This is, by the way, completely improvised. I know most people, I don't think most people believe that.
The problem is we can't, when I try to sing with you on Zoom, the timing is bad. So we'll have to just let it go, and maybe I'll do something in post. But it's goodbye from us. It's Happy New Year to everyone. Booksboys.com is where you can find us, and on Instagram at Booksboys Podcast. Little Alfred is... got his antlers on, and he's wishing us all a Merry Christmas, New Year's, Reyes, and all the rest of it. And I think that's us. The DJ is not going to spin the record. PJ is going to spin the quattro. And we'll be back in about a month.
Nice. And see ya! And here is the... We're going to play a song, right?
Let's go.
This is literally not planned, guys. As you might know, it's slightly unprofessional. I am literally looking up because I do forget them sometimes. Just looking up the chords again here. Right. So, Dean, this is an unusual one. I'm going to sing Oh Tannenbaum. Do you know that song?
I do not. I recognize the tune. I do not recognize the lyrics.
It's Oh Christmas Tree. But I do think it was written in German first. But, you know, you can go wild at that. You can go like hashtag you ignoramus. But,
okay.
But I'd rather not have that hashtag, as you might. And this is the song, Oh, Tannenbaum, and Tannenbaum, completely improvised. I just bought a quattro to my home. So if I make some mistakes, I hope you'll find in your heart to forgive me. Okay.
Deep breath. Oh. Oh, Tannenbaum, wie grünst in deine Blätter. Du grünst dich nur zur Sommerzeit, nein, auch im Winter, wenn es schneit. Oh, Tannenbaum, wie grün sind deine Blätter. Oh, Tannenbaum, du kannst mir sehr gefallen. Wie oft hab ich in der Zeit ein Blau von dir mich hoch erfreut. Oh,
and Merry Christmas a bit late and a Happy
New Year!
Cool, that's nice. Do you like the song or do you want me to sing an English song, to be fair now?
Books Boys was presented by The Dean and PJ Burke in association with Thaddeus Penguin Productions. Ha! This episode was brought to you by our sponsor,
The Bookish Man.
If you would like to get in touch, you can email us at booksboys@hotmail.com or visit us at booksboys.com. The intro uses Driving in the 70s from the Of Soundtracks and Garage Bands EP by Trapdoor. And the outro uses Dog's Light by Bravo Max from the album of the same name. All music used is either Podsafe or used with permission.
If you'd like to support the show, go to patreon.com/booksboys, get the show early and all of our bonus Boof Band the Boys shows. And you can also check out our music on Spotify or Apple Music.
Thank you kindly for listening to us. Please tell your friends. And come back next time for another episode of Books Boys.
Read some books!
This meeting is being recorded.
Oh, Dean, hold on a second. I have to get headphones. Hold on a second. Hold on.
Keep your trousers on.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.